This is PCJ Radio International. Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. A three-year undercover operation in China has revealed as many as 600 whale sharks a year are killed to supply one factory alone. Estimates go as high as 1,000 sharks slaughtered for food and cosmetics produced each year in China. Whale sharks are protected in China, but enforcing the law is lax. Karen Snowden has more.
Swimming with whale sharks has become a famous tourist attraction at Western Australia's Ningaloo Reef for a short time every year. The global tourist trade is worth millions of dollars, but one dead whale shark can fetch $30,000 in China. The shark is actually a filter-feeding fish, which can weigh 20 tons. Paul Hilton, a conservation photojournalist and co-director of Hong Kong-based NGO Wildlife Risk, made three trips between 2010 and last year to the town of Puchi in China's southeast, following a tip-off.
So we decided to set up a small seafood trading company. So we organised a business trip where we met with a gentleman called Mr. Li, who runs the China Wenzhou Yuqing Marine Organism Health Protection Foods Co. Limited, and there the processing plant and the courtyard was just full of giant whale shark fins.
And did Mr. Lee offer the fact that he was processing up to 600 whale sharks a year?
That's right, yes.
Whale shark hunting and the sale and export of products are banned in China, which has signed the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Paul Hilton says the fins and meat from the factory stay in China, while customers for the oil and skins are in North America and Europe, and the fisheries authorities lack the resources to stop the trade.
Recently this week, there was a spokesperson that wanted to remain anonymous from the Chinese fisheries side, saying they're just totally understaffed and they don't have the resources to do more for endangered species. So, you know, there's loopholes all through the system. People are taking backhanders.
The work by Wildlife Risk backs up a report from July 2012 by Murdoch University's Brad Norman. The director of EcoOcean collaborated with researchers at Shandong University in a survey of 2,500 fishermen in eight provinces, and found a potential crisis is facing the endangered whale sharks.
The chief of the Hainan Fisheries and a couple of the interviewees believe that there's more than 1,000 whale sharks caught in coastal waters around China, and that's a massive number of sharks.
What are you saying, 1,000 a year?
Yes, yes. And given the area where Wildlife Risk went to is the sort of shark capital of China, you know, a figure of 600 for one factory, there's obviously the potential to be many factories taking large numbers of whale sharks at the same time.
Brad Norman says studies of the whale shark's migratory habits has just started, making it difficult to assess the impact of one country's harvesting on other places.
Given that they're highly migratory on a global scale, protection in one country will not assist the conservation of these animals if they move out of that jurisdiction and they're in an area where they're actively hunted. And this is our issue with some locations, including China, where large numbers of whale sharks are being hunted, and it will affect the global population.
Is there any way of knowing what that global population is?
The global population of whale sharks is at present unknown. However, we can see trends, and the trends in recent years has been that the numbers are declining.
Taiwan also killed whale sharks until about 6 years ago, although it's thought some illegal hunting and a black market trade continues. Paul Hilton says China now has the opportunity to shut down its illegal factories.
For that to happen, though, I think there has to be a lot of dialogue behind closed doors. But now we've shone a light on the issue. Now hopefully that dialogue can start.
Singapore's unemployment is one of the lowest in the world and remains the envy of many countries. But despite that, workers there are said to be some of the most dissatisfied in Asia. Shivaya Naivak has the story.
Singapore is well known for being home to the highest proportion of millionaire households in the world. But despite its wealth, this tiny island of 5 million people is also home to the unhappiest workforce in Asia. A study by global HR consultancy firm Randstad has found that more than 60% of employees are planning to leave their present job within the next 12 months. Steve Shepherd is an employment market analyst with Randstad. He says Singapore's relatively low unemployment rate is a key reason for employees wanting to change jobs.
If we do then look at what is the next highest motivator on their scale, it's not about salary and remuneration, it's actually about work-life balance. They're feeling they're working much harder and not necessarily getting the recognition or the opportunities as a result of that.
If employees frequently change jobs, that has an impact on companies and their bottom line.
We do know that high staff turnover is a key factor in productivity drivers within business. So any organisation that is experiencing high turnover is likely to have a flow-on effect to productivity as experienced staff leave those businesses.
Nasira Banu works in Singapore's biomedical sector.
A large percentage of them, they do complain that the pay is not right and they do work long hours.
She says employees should implement work-life balance measures to retain staff.
Employers should try to relate a bit of this work-life balance to their employees. Whenever they have finished a major assignment, maybe you can give them a 1 or 2 weekdays off.
Steve Shepherd from Randstad says it's not a one-size-fits-all solution when it comes to work-life balance measures.
For some people, a work-life balance could mean working less overtime. For others, it could be about having more flexible work arrangements so they can drop the kids off at school or study part-time or a range of things.
The report also found that Australia and India have the happiest employees in the region. Only one-third of the people surveyed plan to leave their jobs in Australia in the next 6 years.
In Australia, the number one reason why people will stay is good work-life balance. Number two reason is flexible work options. So we've seen Australian employers really focus quite heavily over the last 10 years, I think, about how they deliver a more flexible work environment for their employees. And I think we're starting to see that now manifest itself in employee satisfaction.
Singaporean employers should make the change, according to Steve Shepherd from Randstad. Dissatisfaction in their jobs would only encourage a high staff turnover, and that is going to affect productivity and eventually profits.
Scientists have confirmed that the latest aviation flu virus has claimed the first human life victim, a 70-year-old woman from southeastern China. The findings were published in a medical journal, The Lancet. The deputy director of Melbourne's International Influenza Research Centre says that at this stage it appears to be an isolated case, but the World Health Organization says it is monitoring developments. Sarah Dingle has the story.
There's a number of different types of avian influenza, including the deadly H5N1. But now Chinese scientists have identified another new virus which is transmissible to humans. This new strain of H10N8 avian influenza has claimed its first victim, according to a study in The Lancet. A 73-year-old woman from Nanchang visited a live poultry market 4 days before falling sick, but the scientists warned the exact source of human infection cannot be confirmed. She developed severe pneumonia and multiple organ failure and died just days later in December last year. Dr. Ian Barr is the deputy director of one of 5 World Health Organization influenza collaborating research centres around the world.
The strain has been around for quite a while. It's found in wild birds and doesn't do them any harm. This is the first report of a human infection and following fatality.
How does this strain differ to previous forms of this influenza?
Well, this is a subtype which only has rarely infected humans before, only 2 or 3 times before, and usually it's a very mild infection when that does happen in humans. So this is unusual in that it infected this elderly lady and it's led to her death.
The report's authors say this strain has evolved some genetic characteristics which may allow it to replicate efficiently in humans. Is that cause for concern?
It has replicated clearly in this woman, but she does have a number of pre-existing ailments which may have aided this virus becoming a problem and infecting her and killing her in the end analysis.
The authors of this paper say the potential for a pandemic should not be underestimated. How concerned are you by this report?
Well, I think we're always concerned when new viruses end up in humans and has a fatal outcome as it did in this case. I think, you know, it's another one of these watching briefs that we need to keep an eye on and make sure that there aren't other viruses of a similar nature or slightly different type of virus to this one, which might have more of an impact. But I don't think this current virus has that potential to be a pandemic virus. So there's now 18 different subtypes of influenza A. This is one of those. This is, again, as I said earlier, a very rare form to infect humans. Normally, humans are only infected with three or four different varieties of influenza A. It adds to the list of viruses which can infect man, but whether or not it's going to increase in numbers or die out is hard to say at this stage. What we don't know is how prevalent this virus is in the poultry and in China. So I think we need to understand that situation better. If this virus has become more widespread in poultry, then, you know, we might get a better understanding of the possibilities of this virus then coming in contact with man and causing more cases in humans.
The study says another case of human infection with H10N8 was reported in Nanchang City just last month.
Well, despite the fact that elections did take place in Thailand last week, well, this hasn't put the protest at bay. Demonstrators also prevented millions of voters from casting their ballots in the Thai elections. So it seems that this is going to be an ongoing story. To find out the latest, Jim Middleton spoke to the ABC's correspondent in Thailand, Norman Hermont.
Norm, just how real now is the prospect of judicial intervention? How would the voters of Thailand react to having the decision about who is in government taken out of their hands by the courts rather than by a democratic vote?
Well, this does really put Thailand's Elections Commission in a very difficult position, Jim, because essentially they're faced with what they're now calling an incomplete election because of the fact that voting was unable to be taken place in so many parts of the country. So now, as you've mentioned, there's this prospect of perhaps judicial intervention in the months ahead as legal challenges come to this vote. And certainly those who support the government of Yingluck Shinawat and the Pheu Thai Party, they will be watching that very carefully because this is a road they know very well. Don't forget there have been two previous parties that are aligned with Thaksin Shinawat that have been dissolved by the courts. There's been a previous prime minister who was in a pro-Thaksin Shinawat party who was stripped of office by the courts, so they are very sensitive about judicial decisions.
Is there any sign of activity on the streets today? Is there any sign of ramping up of those protests, either pro or anti-government?
Well, there's no sign of ramping up, but the significant development today is that the anti-government protest leader, Suthep Thaugsuban, has said that the protests are going to continue. In fact, he led his supporters on a 14-kilometer march across Bangkok today. What happened was two of the big protest sites that have been in permanently encamped for the last 3 or 4 weeks in the city have now moved to a park in the center of the city, and there are also other protest sites that remain. So they are vowing that the fight is not over. They say they are going to stay on the streets, although numbers do appear to be down. Typically what happens is during the day there might only be a few hundred people at these sites and they grow at night, but there is a feeling that even though these crowds are smaller, there's no sign really that these protests are going to be going away anytime soon.
And what about the pro-government supporters? Is there evidence that as far as the government is concerned that low-key is good and therefore that they may be discouraging them from returning to the streets, that it is not in the government's interest to have disruption and protest?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jim. In fact, over the weekend, people may have seen pictures of that rather serious shootout that took place in North Bangkok on the day before the vote. The red leader, the so-called red shirt leader, Ko Thi, who was believed to be responsible for gathering that crowd, what we've heard is that the red shirt leadership are very unhappy with him because that is exactly the kind of confrontation the red shirts don't want. They have been taking a hands-off approach, and that is simply because there is some fear from senior people in the red shirt movement that if they do move aggressively, that might give the army the excuse it needs to step in and perhaps even see another coup. So there has been a very much hands-off approach by the red shirt leaders and, of course, by the government of Yingluck Shinawat.
Whatever else this election was supposed to be, Yingluck Shinawat wanted it to be a vote of confidence, a show of support for her and her government. The turnout has been disappointingly low, I would have thought, from the government's perspective. It's hardly a vote of confidence, is it?
Well, it's hard to say, Jim. I mean, it is a very low turnout figure. We're seeing today something about 45% of voters who were able to vote, registered voters in the parts of Thailand where the election did take place. That's a very low number. It is really hard to cast this as a vote of confidence, although I suppose it's hard to see how any new government formed from this election could really have much of a sense of legitimacy when you consider those turnout numbers, and that is going to pose a problem for Yingluck Shinawat as she moves forward.
Correspondent Norman Hammond in Bangkok.
That was the ABC's Jim Middleton speaking to Norman Hammond, the ABC correspondent in Thailand, about the Thai elections that were held last Sunday. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Parent. Vanuatu's Departments of Foreign Affairs and Immigration said they are aware of new allegations its embassy in Beijing is selling passports in China. Vanuatu has no ambassador in Beijing since the end of a contract of the previous ambassador, Willie Jimmy, ended last year. But it currently employs Ni Vanuatu, a Chinese national, both with diplomatic passports. To find out more, Hilary Bulow spoke to Jeff Bonavari, the Vanuatu opposition.
Last year we have been touched very much on the issue of passport and so forth. But this time we would like to try and control our media on this issue on passport. But recently this year we have received another one from China, and yes, it is true. We have confirmed that we have received. It is in a website, but it is in Chinese. So we have converted to English, so that media can aware of the issue.
And website is about what?
Oh, it's the website is trying to advertise the Chinese can apply and pay the visa from certain people in China.
Did you inform the government about the allegations?
Well, this is it could be a scandal. It could be a scandal if we look at it in a general view. But the government had to confirm and had to confirm if there was something that had been going on that in this direction.
But how an embassy, Vanuatu embassy, can sell Vanuatu visa, because under the Immigration Act only principal immigration officer has the authority to grant or issue a visa.
Yes, that is why it could be a scandal, because normally the embassy of Vanuatu would not sell any such visa. It is only through the principal immigration of Vanuatu should issue this authority. But then, if in this case, then the government had to have an investigation into it immediately.
Do you know how much a visa can be sold in China?
Oh, well, we will not assume that we have a visa have been sold, because people have been using this visa to travel through China to Macau or any other place where it is not authorized, then this is why we have collected this information, because authorities in China have concern on this issue.
I understand that recently, about 2 or 3 years ago, we heard about the allegation of selling of Vanuatu visa in Chinese street, but this website, I understand that it is a recent website dated 14th of this month.
Yes, that is why we have to have an issue published to the media last week, and we've sent. That's why we have the Office of the Opposition have sent out this issue for public to aware of this issue.
It means that somebody is making money by selling Vanuatu visa, and those visas are fake visa, and it is an illegal activity.
Yes. The government should deal with this issue immediately, as I said, because it can go out of hand, and many people can buy a fake visa because it is not a genuine visa that the people are buying it now.
And finally on the program, Pacific artists are on center stage in Sydney after the opening of an exhibition of new work from seven island nations. The artists come from cities as well as remote areas and mountain villages, but one thing they have in common is the quality of their work. Jemiah Garrett reports next from the Shapiro Gallery in the upmarket suburb of Woollahra.
The sounds of Tevaka are leaking out into the warm night as the crowd gathers to see what this year's Makete Place has on offer. Upstairs are the Tongan artists. Under the gaze of striking contemporary paintings by Tevita Latu and Lopeti Nawamo, I meet fibre artist Sione Malaseni. Last year, some of his pieces were bought by the Australian Museum. Now he's standing next to what he calls his Lady Gaga dress.
This year I'm bringing the coconut fibre carmine handbag made out of coconut fibre, and also the Katomosikaka.
The dress is absolutely beautiful. It's got a very large collar on it with beautiful shells. Can you tell us a bit about it and who made it?
Okay. I created this dress because 2012 there was this Pacific Island Leaders Summit in Japan. So it's just my way of showing Japan and the whole world that we can do it something unique back in the islands. So I decided to create this coconut fiber dress, which was somehow very popular in Japan because I named it Gogo Gaga, which is the inspiration is Lady Gaga, and the material used is the coconut fiber.
Makete Place is put on by Pacific Trade and Invest, the Pacific Forum's trade promotion arm, and it's in its fourth year. While sales are important, the show's artistic director, Ruth Cholai, says the very best quality work and the creation of long-standing business connections are even more of a priority.
That is one of the criteria of Makete Place, is that the craftsmanship has to be of a very, very high standard, because we're trying to change that perception of Pacific artisan work being tourist-made only. So it's just lifting that standard and saying it has to be good quality.
The strategy seems to be working. Caroline Sherman from the famous Sherman Gallery's family arrived even before the opening was underway.
I think it's absolutely stunning, and I've been here now four times. I haven't even opened the exhibition yet, and I'm blown away by the absolute beauty and just incredible versatility of all the different textures. And my background's textiles, so I'm like, wow, this is incredible. It's like the most amazing stuff ever. So I said to Ruth, who's the lady running it, can we please work together? And I'll come to PNG and visit the communities and talk to people about how we can work together, and I can design some stuff and they can make some samples, and I'll show, like, you know, leading fashion houses. And so, yeah.
Along with the billums and bark cloth that are inspiring Caroline Sherman are carvings, basketry, paintings and drawings. Lalavai Pasetta has paintings on show, but increasingly, in collaboration with his new wife, Nikki Mariner, he's taking his art off the wall and onto the human body.
I'm a salmon artist, and tattoo is a salmon art. I just love to use it all the time, no matter if it's on a canvas, a skin, a material, or even on woods. I'm proud of myself, I'm proud of my art, and proud to be a salmon artist.
Your wife, Nikki, is both your muse and your canvas. Tell us about how that came about.
Well, she's the inspiration, you know. She loves art. She loves my art. And that is like a big challenge for me every day. She helps me a lot with ideas. And so all the art that I'm doing now is not just from my mind. It's also her ideas. We kind of like combine it together and make it happen. But she's my inspiration.
And Nikki, tell us, what tattoos do you have?
All of my tattoos are salmon inspired. The first tattoo I had, I was looking for an artist to draw it, a design for me that was very Samoan, and I met him at the Festival of Pacific Arts. He was carving. So I asked him, I knew he was an artist, could you draw me a design? And that's how we met. And someone else did that one, but he's done the other one. So I have a traditional hand tattoo. We have a tattooed wedding ring and armbands, and yep, that's what I have.
How does it feel handing your body over to be the canvas?
Well, I trust him. I trust his eyes. When I first met him, one thing that amazed me was how he sees the world. Walking around with him, he could see everything three times deeper than most people. He would stop and look at a tree in a different way, and that just amazed me.
Lalavai Pasetta will be holding 4 live tattooing demonstrations. Marketi Place runs until February 16th.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you would like to let us know what you think of the program, well, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this program again, as well as past editions and all other programs from PCJ, by visiting our website, www.pcjmedia.com. And that's it. And if you want to click on Focus Asia Pacific, you'll find the link for the show on the right menu. Anyway, that's it. That's all we have time for. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Goodbye, everyone.